This is Midwest Moxie, a show about our region's visionary entrepreneurs and the experiences that shape them. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, Executive Director of Five Lakes Institute. Nancy Benovich Gilby started out at Apollo Computer, but that was just the beginning. Boston's entrepreneurial culture and a new world of workstations and personal computers exposed many opportunities. Nancy got involved in 14 startups, five of which she founded or co-founded, and eight of which had exits. After startup number 10, in 2014, she returned home to Michigan to work on several more startups and share her expertise with other entrepreneurs. Nancy, welcome to Midwest Moxie.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You got the I can take over the world bug when you were studying computer engineering at University of Michigan. Tell us about that.
Well, when I was a sophomore, I was offered a position to work in the dean's office for the engineering school. And I happened to work with three amazing men, Jim Duderstadt, Chuck Best, and Dan Atkins, all three of which were quite young and very much wanting to take over the world. I started with punch cards and actually tearing paper at the computer center, and they wanted to replace the Michigan mainframe with Apple Macintoshes and Apollo workstations. I just thought, there's no way that's ever going to happen. It's such a big thing. Michigan had developed their own operating system. Everybody who used IBM mainframes used it. But lo and behold, they brought Steve Jobs on campus, and they also brought other folks from Apollo Computer. And within 6 to 9 months, every computer lab was filled with these amazing workstations. And I actually even got to meet Steve Jobs and have lunch with him and Dana Lewin when I was a part of a committee to look at these computers that were coming in.
Wow. What year was that?
That was 1982.
So Michigan must have been one of the first universities to move away from mainframes.
It was, and it was the first university to sign on for Apple, you know, at the time, their very innovative program for helping students to buy Macintoshes very cheaply. I think I actually bought one, and it was, you know, one of the first four off the line.
Wow.
My mom still has in her basement. And it was just, you know, an amazing opportunity to be exposed to that kind of environment for learning, especially in computer engineering.
So speaking of Apple, the research you did during graduate school was funded by Apple and by Apollo Computer. Both mm-hmm. offered you jobs when you graduated. Why did you choose Apollo?
So it's very interesting. At the time, Apple was known more for a scrappy garage kind of startup environment, where Apollo had amazing tools. They had some of the first source code control tool in an environment. They had the most innovative networking and the most high performing computer graphics. So I just thought, you know, being a young engineer right out of school, I couldn't work with any more talented people than what I could find at Apollo. But really important to me was they had a technical ladder that went all the way up to fellow. And some of the early folks who were part of Apollo, amazing computer engineers and scientists, actually sat at board level. And I love that idea that engineering influenced an engineering company all the way up to board level. So I wanted to see how that worked. And it was amazing. I mean, there were so many startups that were so successful that actually were Apollo engineers.
So you eventually ended up in Silicon Valley. But for starters, you were in Boston at Apollo. You left Apollo to work on Technology, a startup launched by Mitch Kapoor, the founder of Lotus, the spreadsheet company. In the beginning, your team was developing a software product for Apple computers, and you didn't really have good direction on that product. How did you find your path?
This was an amazing story of customer discovery before there was such a thing. Mitch hired a VP of marketing that had come from Lotus, Connell Ryan, and I was one developer, one of three developers on the software product. It wasn't going anywhere, as you mentioned. And Connell said, look, you three engineers, you're going to go out to Kendall Square, which where our offices were, and each Wednesday, you're going to recruit people to come up and meet Mitch, get a free dinner, and you're going to watch them use this product. And every week, we're going to do a new release until people love this product. And I thought, oh my God, how is this ever going to work? You know, engineers going down and you know, the opportunity to meet Mitch, get a free dinner, you know, give feedback on a product that hadn't been launched yet. And it was genius. We went from a product that was all over the map to an award-winning, one of the best-selling Macintosh applications at the time within about 6 or 8 weeks of this. And it really opened my eyes to how much of an effect engineers have on developing a successful product, as well as just how important it is to get right there with the users of your product and make sure you're building it for them.
What great lessons to learn so early on. Next, you co-founded a startup called Component Software that worked on a precursor technology to Java. Then you worked for another startup. You kept flipping between starting companies and working at companies for 2 decades. Tell us about some of the other things you learned over the years about building a successful startup.
Well, no matter if you've been a serial entrepreneur, it's your first time, some of the things I learned are it's not about how big of a round your funding is. It's not about how many times you've built successful startups. It's really about finding a need, finding a target audience, and then following that, you know, with a vengeance in order to build a successful product. And I had amazing mentors through this process. I actually worked with a fellow by the name of Joe Lassiter, who ended up being a professor at the Harvard Business School, who taught me a lot of techniques for listening to customers and turning it into actionable requirements. And not just that, but a continual interaction with your customers all the way through the development process and then forever, really. And when I've had the opportunity to use that process, which was actually written about in 3 Harvard Business School case studies, it's worked. It still works. I'm still doing it today with companies that I help advise.
So don't lock your engineers in the closet.
No, it's got to be a full team perspective. Your engineers, your sales, your marketing, your executives, you know, even sometimes I drag in board members into these discussions because you have a unique perspective, but engineers are the best at finding problems and even better at solving problems. So get them in there and use their brains as part of exactly what you need to do for your roadmap and strategy.
You were involved in way too many startups to detail. Firefly, a spin-out from MIT Media Lab that sold to Microsoft. Wildfire, which sold to Orange. MarketSoft, which sold to Unica IBM. We could go on and on. But let's step back and look more broadly. One of the things that really intrigues me about the way you look at this, you say you use the Walt Disney approach to forming teams. How does that work?
Well, I was always really interested in what makes a successful team, because 99.9% of the time at a startup, it's the people inside the startup that get in their own way of being successful. And a lot of times it's egos getting in the way. It's I know this, you don't getting in the way instead of listening to customers. What Walt Disney did, I thought was fascinating. I heard this in a book that I read about his biography. He actually forms teams around this idea that you can have dreamers, and you have to have dreamers if you're really going to build a revolutionary product. You can have one critic, and you have to have realists. And he used that balance because dreamers need to dream. The realists need to know how to take those dreams and put them into action. But critics can be cancer. You have to have people who have critical thinking, but not. If you have too much criticism, you're not going to be able to do the impossible. And when I followed that, it's amazing how well it works. In a lot of cases, I'm the realist or dreamer helping the realists, but I'm very careful to only have one critic.
I was going to ask which one you were. you worked at startups in Boston first, then you ended up in Silicon Valley and other parts of the West Coast. We hear so much about women in tech, particularly in Silicon Valley, and how they aren't treated well. What was your experience on both coasts with that issue?
Much of that, and I also did startups in London too, as part of the Silicon Valley experience when I was doing mobile software. But one of the things that was interesting was when I was an engineer and working at startups, there was nothing like it because people just needed to get work done. And if you were a hard worker and you were smart and you produced, they loved you, everything was wonderful. As I started to take on more leadership roles and executive roles, that's when it got very difficult because venture capitalists, especially at the time, were all white men on Sand Hill Road. And the idea that a leader or an executive with blonde hair and an undergraduate and graduate engineering degree just didn't make a lot of sense. So it was difficult in certain cases. I was given a lot of opportunities after, you know, proving myself. But usually the biggest challenges, again, would come within a company. Somebody would be hired who would be a colleague who was very threatened by my ability to create teams and produce. And sometimes it would feel like I had a big bullseye on my back. And when you have those type of people, and if they're supported in an organization, it can be just absolute misery. So I've been through several of those. And it's always my goal to help support women, to support women and minorities, people who haven't been traditionally part of startups, to ensure that they have the opportunities to really thrive and succeed.
Is the Midwest more like Boston or more like Silicon Valley?
Much more like Boston. Boston was one of my favorite places to do startups because, in fact, a lot of people from Michigan had migrated there. But it's very much roll up your sleeves, get the job done, and, you know, include everybody. You just got to get the job done. And I find that in many ways, even more so in the Midwest. People who are doing startups are passionate. But in general, the ones who actually start to do something are the ones that put their ego aside, build teams, and just focus on the prize, which is building successful products and a business around it. And that attitude, I think, is so important to what's going to be, you know, the 21st century ideal of a startup. And I think so much of it is here in the Midwest, and it starts with the people. You know, we have amazing universities. We have amazing workforce and challenges and problems, but it always comes down to the people. And I think the people are here. You know, now we just need the deep pockets and capital to be here.
Well, the Midwest is lucky you moved back and you've really spread your expertise around a lot of organizations now. And I'm sure many startups are benefiting. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us, Nancy.
My pleasure. Again, thank you for inviting me.
You can read more about today's guest by visiting WUWM.com. Don't forget, you can also listen to the show as a podcast if you'd like to take us on the go. Just search for Midwest Moxie wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher. We're going to take a quick break, then we'll be back with more Midwest Moxie. This is Midwest Moxie, a show about our region's visionary entrepreneurs and the experiences that shape them. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, Executive Director of Five Lakes Institute. Katie Thompson and her husband, Brian, did exactly what many experts warn against. They started their company with an amazing technology and no idea what to do with it. But if they didn't commercialize Brian's discovery, they reasoned, who would? Fortunately, their gambit worked out. Katie is co-founder and chief operating officer of St. Louis-based Elemental Enzymes, which develops novel and sustainable biotech products for agriculture. The company has 59 full-time employees and has raised about $10 million. Katie, welcome to Midwest Moxie.
Thanks, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
You and Brian met at University of Missouri, where he was developing novel enzyme production methods that would form the basis of your company. Neither of you thought Brian's technologies would be commercialized otherwise. Why did you think that?
Well, we knew the university didn't really understand the technology. You know, university offices of technology transfer offices or the offices that patent the technologies, there's a lot of different fields that go into those same offices. And we didn't really have a, you know, really good, strong product concepts in like a specific market. So we knew they were going to have trouble finding people interested in licensing it because, I mean, who do you go to?
Why were you so excited about it then if you didn't have an idea for what to do with it?
I guess like a lot of, you know, scientists, lab scientists, you're developing things and or discovering new things and you hope that they lead to making the world better somehow, that that science gets commercialized and something happens with it. It doesn't just go in this box of knowledge to sit there. And we could tell that that could be the case with this kind of technology.
So tell us a little about the technology. I know it's complicated, but he was studying bacteria, right?
Right. And he was studying the very outside layer of a subtype of bacteria that can basically kind of go dormant in soil for really long periods of time. So they have a really sort of stable outside layer. And he discovered a sequence tag where you could add enzymes or other proteins to that layer of these bacteria.
And your initial idea was that you could use it for soil remediation to clean up bad soil, right?
Right, right. So we were thinking of putting enzymes to either degrade or convert some forever chemicals in the soil. Soil's kind of a tough environment to put, you know, biological living products in because it's, you know, there's a lot of bacteria and enzymes that degrade other biological organisms. There's a lot of recycling and turnover there. So there's not a lot of things that are made to last a long time in soil that are biological.
Okay, so spoiler alert, that's not what you ended up doing. That wasn't your use case. But let's go back to, you were PhD students in life sciences.
Yeah.
You were both working
yeah.
on your PhDs. Neither of you knew anything about running a company. How did you learn how to do that with your soil remediation idea that you weren't going to end up with?
I guess Ryan sort of, maybe at his heart, he's an entrepreneur. I guess before school, before even going back in biology, he, you know, he was the one selling candy out of his backpack at school. Or, you know, before he went into college, he kind of ran a deli in a cafeteria type place. So he had a little bit of that background. So he had an interest. But as he kind of had this idea, the university patented it, and we kind of knew they didn't really know what was going on. So he went back and took classes that were available to either audit or through different programs for entrepreneurs at the university. One was the Small Business Technology Development Center had, you know, some programs to help you write a business plan over your technology. And then I took classes with the Regional Economic Development Center. You know, they're designed to be relatively inexpensive. I think I took QuickBooks and accounting. I learned that side of the business. And then we did some other things later to kind of learn business, how to write business plans.
And at one point, you had some business students working with you through the university?
Yeah, that was really interesting. So once we finally got a place to start, the University of Missouri had this business incubator with labs in it, and we were able to rent a small lab. And the people running the center said, hey, do you want to use your technology to put in this business plan competition for these MBA students that are meeting here because they need new technologies to write their business plans on? And we said, yeah, sure. But just don't tell them that we're kind of using these enzyme stabilized for remediation. Let's see what market they can come up with for a use of stabilized enzymes. So we wrote a business plan with them as well.
It's crazy to think you could have gotten probably pretty good jobs in industry. What kept you? Did you wake up one day and say, whoa, what are we doing?
Well, I think we said that at the beginning, but yeah, I mean, so Brian was a little ahead of me. He was working on a postdoc as I was finishing up my PhD. And, you know, we came from both working class families and, you know, graduate students are definitely very well off. No, not. We were pretty confident in our ability to go find jobs and find work. And so we said, well, let's try this business thing for 2 years and just see if we can get some traction because we have nothing to lose, right? Like, we've been living like this for, it feels like forever at this point. I mean, you've been in school for like 10 years, you know, what's two more years to add on? And we had the, I don't know how we had it, but we had the foresight to say, well, it's a lot easier to give up something you've never had than give up something you've already achieved or had.
You kind of drew the line at your garage, though. Brian did have the idea of starting the company in the garage. And what was your problem with that?
He wanted to be a garage startup so bad. Brian really, really did. And he was like, you know, we can order this lab equipment off of eBay. And we were renting this really tiny house that was, I swear the walls were made of cardboard. And I said, Brian, you cannot plug an autoclave in here. We'll burn it down. So I convinced him to not do that. And we got a half of a bench, a tiny little bench space at the business incubator on campus a couple miles away.
Nice. You ended up moving, you raised your first funding round. You still didn't have exactly what you were going to do with this product. How did you land on agriculture?
Yeah, that's a really interesting story. So we had this idea for soil remediation. We kind of had worked with those students. They had decided to write a business plan on detergent enzymes. And we're like, okay, well, that's not so great because, you know, Tide's got that market cornered and all these other big enzyme companies, they know what to do with detergent enzyme. So we went back and we rewrote a business plan on the soil remediation with those students. We entered some business plan competitions that ended up being really well. And we met another investor who helped us kind of pitch on soil remediation, but we knew there were so many enzyme markets out there that we could potentially fit into another market. So when we pitched to angels, you know, we wrote the business plan on soil remediation, but the real pitch was, well, we could pivot this technology into other markets as we find them. And that's really something that you want to invest in as a startup, because oftentimes your first idea isn't it and the best idea. So we got some credit from someone who'd been an entrepreneur before to kind of explain that to our investors. And I think that really helped us. And then as we went to these angel investment groups, we actually went to one in St. Louis, and there was some veterans from Monsanto. You know, they had been there 25 years or so, and they were like, well, you're making these enzyme things last longer in soil. And I'm still not convinced they knew exactly what an enzyme was at this point, but that's okay. And we're like, yeah, that's it. Have you ever thought about doing anything for a plant? And we're like, you know, Brian's background's in microbiology and immunology, and my background is actually in adult stem cells and muscle and development. No, we haven't really thought about something that an enzyme could do for a plant. But Brian went to the literature, and it turns out people had tried and they had failed. So maybe if we could make those enzymes last longer in soil, then that wouldn't fail. And we gave it a try.
Was it helpful or a hindrance that neither of you had much background in plants?
I think it was helpful. It really let us approach the industry from a different point of view. When we went to the literature, we found enzymes that had been used, and we went back to, you know, some of the enzymes that we had on the platform already. And we're like, oh, these are kind of from the same families and similar. We'll just try what we've already, the product concepts we've already created. So we went out and got some seed and got some soil and grow lights and just gave it a shot. And, you know, when we were reading the literature, we could read how all of these plant scientists and were doing their experiments. And, you know, some basic things, like a lot of them were sterilizing the soil, which, you know, they didn't want some fungus in the soil to mess up their experiment or whatever. We could understand that, but we were like, we don't have time to like do that experiment and then do the next experiment and then do the next experiment. We just need to know if this idea is going to work at all. So we took what we had and we took, you know, non-sterile soil you know, and then later we tried soil from a couple different areas. We didn't even have an analysis on it. I mean, we knew it was good to do an analysis on it, but we didn't really have time at that point. We're just like, okay, they look a lot different. And we tried to test as close to the real world settings as we could, because we didn't have enough time or money. We just needed to know if it was going to work, or should we refocus back on remediation, you know, at this point. So I think taking those at the time were relatively small risks in our time. But then when those were successful, we continued to follow them up.
So the difference, I mean, let's talk about all the things your products can do now. You can get better crop yields, is what you've just been talking about. You can help reduce fertilizer use.
Mm-hmm.
Other things.
Okay. So we kind of have different categories of products now. So the enzymes kind of that we first developed, you can think of them as, a lot of people know you have probiotics in your gut. Right now are microbes in your gut that help you digest your food. Plants have that same sort of thing around the roots, where they have microorganisms they grow symbiotically with. They release enzymes. They help them digest more nutrients, or the ability to absorb more nutrients from the soil. Those are kind of the categories where a lot of our soil enzymes are. So you can potentially, you can reduce fertilizer by adding enzymes, because the plants pull out more of those nutrients from the soil. And then since the first patent, we've added to it quite a bit, where we have some other products that are more like vaccines for plants. So they kind of trigger the plant's immune system to defend itself against disease. Those are some of the two main categories. We also have some products that help with stress that the plants have.
You've come a long way since 2011 when you started the company. It now has more than 300 patents and a global footprint. What's your goal for Elemental Enzymes?
Yeah, well, there are still patent applications. We have a lot issued, but 300 patent applications that are globally. And I would say we're really just getting traction on that global footprint. We would really like to grow and invest in the trial testing that's needed around the world. It's really expensive, lots of trials, and those global product registrations to fully expand outside the U.S. We've seen a lot of really good initial results and data, and our partners have seen that. In those, you know, countries, we have several years of testing, but it takes a lot to get ag products registered. I mean, and depending on the product, you know, you're going to have EPA-like registrations that take a number of years. So we're really interested in continuing and to invest in that segment of our business.
You can read more about today's guest by visiting wuwm.com. Don't forget, you can also listen to the show as a podcast if you'd like to take us on the go. Just search for Midwest Moxie wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher. Midwest Moxie was created by executive producer Audrey Nowakowski and me. Today's episode was produced by Audrey Nowakowski. Join us next Sunday at 7 p.m. to hear from more visionary Midwestern founders building innovative companies. That's right here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.